down there as soon as I can. She ended the call, slipped the phone back into her hip pocket, and chewed her lip. She pushed back through the dining room doors and spotted Allie Trimble over at the second table, adding cold water to one of the residents' coffee. "Hey, Al, do you have a second?" Marcy asked. Allie looked up, nodded, and started toward her. She was a big woman who carried her bulk with a strangely graceful waddle. She was 50-ish, with jet black hair and a dolphin tattoo just above her right breast. Allie had worked in Happy Home longer than anyone else and had a calm, soothing way with the guests. She often spent her breaks in the palliative care wing, sitting with the residents as they prepared for death. That whole corner of the building creeped Marcy out, and she once had asked Allie how she could stand spending so much time there. "Being close to death reminds me to live," she said, in her spiritual New Age way. "If you concentrate right at the end, you can feel when it's about to happen." Marcy had been sorry she asked. "What's up?" Allie asked. "I just got a call from Aaron's school," Marcy said. "She's fine, but her principal wants me to come in and—"
"Go on," Allie said. "I'll cover for you."
"I owe you."
"You give Eugene his shower this afternoon, and we'll call it even."
"You got it," Marcy said, and was out the door in a flash. Principal Birch was just leaving his 40s, with toned shoulders and a handsome, angular face. A framed photo on his desk, facing outwards, boasted his equally handsome husband and two gorgeous kids. Marcy caught her own reflection in the picture frame and thought, "That'll do." She had been effortlessly pretty when she was younger, but now she couldn't remember the last time she wore makeup. Other mothers had time to crimp, clip, pluck, and wax, but Marcy barely had time to scratch herself.
"Let me start by saying how happy we are with Erin's performance here," Birch said. "She's a very bright student. She's enthusiastic. She loves to learn. Miss Haley tells me she has a particular interest in natural history."
He spoke with a gentle tone, but Marcy couldn't help but feel scolded. Being called to the principal's office had that effect on most people. Besides, there was a big but coming. Birch hadn't called her here in the middle of a workday to tell her how well Aaron was doing in school.
"When she grows up, she wants to be one of those people who make the displays in museums," Marcy said. "Cro-Magnon man fighting saber-toothed tigers, that kind of thing."
"Curator," he said.
"What's that?"
"The people who oversee museum displays, they're called curators."
"Oh, right. Good to know."
Birch opened his top drawer and took out a manila folder. He placed it on the desk and exhaled.
"The point is, Aaron's great, which is why when Miss Haley came to me with this, I was disturbed."
"What is it?" Marcy asked.
"We ask all our fourth graders to keep a journal," he said. "They're encouraged to write down not just what they do, but how they feel doing it. We're pretty open about what they include. Some kids take it more seriously than others. From what I hear, Erin's is quite entertaining. She wrote about a trip to the aquarium that left her feeling, quote, happy yet sad."
Smiling, Marcy said. She liked looking at the jellyfish, but felt sorry for them because they were in a tank instead of being free out in the ocean.
"It's sweet of her to see the world like that," he said. "But last week, Aaron made this."
He took a sheet of paper from the manila folder and handed it to Marcy.
"Take a look."
It was a single photocopied entry from Aaron's journal. There was nothing written there. Instead, in dark shades, she'd drawn a picture. At first, Marcy thought it might be a ladder, but as she looked at it more closely, she saw it was a bird's-eye view of a railroad track. Aaron had taken care to shade in the wooden slats and bolts, halfway down the page, laying half on, half off the tracks, was a little dead girl. The girl had curly hair like Aaron's. Her eyes were hollow black holes, each one covered with a red X to drive home the point. The limbs were broken, splayed outwards at unnatural angles.
"I think I know what this is about," Marcy said.
"Aaron's grandma lets her stay up too late sometimes and watch scary movies. That's where she must have got this idea from. I'll talk to Aaron. I'll talk to my mom too, come to think of it."
"There's more," Birch said.
This time, he gave her the whole folder.
Marcy opened it. Inside were more drawings, all variations of the same subject matter. A little girl, dead on the railroad tracks. In some, there was scribbled red blood leaking from the girl's head. In others, stray dogs had arrived and were sniffing at the body.
Jesus, Marcy muttered.
It's not so much the drawings that are the problem, Birch said. These are obviously very troubling, but it's not uncommon for our students to make artwork like this.
He made rabbits with his fingers as he said the word artwork.
One of our third graders, who will remain nameless, drew a bald eagle on a crucifix for his 4th of July entry.
So what's the problem? Marcy asked.
When Miss Haley saw these sketches, she asked Aaron about them. Aaron became agitated and combative, which is unusual for her, as you know. Miss Haley had never known her to act that way. When she pressed her, Aaron told her the little girl in the picture was her.
Miss Haley asked her why she'd pictured herself as a dead girl, and Aaron said, quote,
because this is how I died.
Oh, kids say creepy stuff all the time, Barb said.
She was sitting at the kitchen table in Marcy's apartment, drinking beer and peeling potatoes, in that order.
When you were 4, I said you had to finish your dinner before you started on dessert. Do you remember what you told me? You said, I don't want to kill you, Mom, but I will if I have to.
I was trying to be funny.
That's my point, Barb said. Kids can't do anything nowadays without setting off alarm bells. A bruise on their face means child abuse. A proclivity for touching one's junk means they were molested.
So Aaron drew a dead little girl. Big deal. She's always had a big imagination. Marcy, who was frying up chicken breasts at the stove for dinner, said,
if you ask me, it's all those movies you let her watch when I'm working the night shift.
Barb picked up an empty beer can and wiggled it. Marcy fetched her a fresh one from the fridge.
Look, I've been a mother much longer than you. Trust me. You turned out all right, didn't you?
Before Marcy could bite back, Aaron came into the kitchen. Marcy's daughter was skinny. Her legs, bare to the thigh, were long and pale. A plastic clip-on earring dangled from each ear. She wore a pale blue t-shirt with a giant octopus on the front. The octopus was using its tentacles to rip apart an old 3-masted sailing ship. Below the image were the words, "You crackin' me up." She opened the fridge, pulled out a juice box, and guzzled it. She was halfway out the door when she realized Marcy and Barb were both staring at her.
What'd I do?
She asked, wiping her mouth with the back of her hand.
I had a meeting with Principal Birch today, Marcy said.
What about?
Sit down, Marcy said. Aaron did as she was told. She pulled up a chair next to her grandma. Marcy set the stove to low and joined them.
Am I in trouble?
Aaron asked.
No, honey. Marcy said. I just want to check in with you. Is everything okay?
What do you mean?
Are you feeling depressed or anxious?
Aaron shook her head.
No, I don't think so.
Your mother wants to know why you drew a dead little girl, Barb said.
Marcy glared at her mother. Subtle, Mom, thanks. Barb shrugged.
So that's what this is about?
Aaron said.
Mrs. Haley has such a big mouth.
Why did you tell her the little girl in the picture was you? Marcy asked.
I don't know,
Aaron said, compulsively shifting her weight from one foot to the other and back again.
It's just a stupid drawing.
You were just messing with your teacher, right, Aaron?
Barb said.
Nobody would blame you if you were.
Aaron gave no response to that. She just went on sipping her juice box until it made empty noises.
Your grandma asked you a question, Marcy prompted.
Aaron was quiet for a moment and then said,
I dreamed it.
Marcy and Barb exchanged a glance over Aaron's head.
You dreamed what, honey?
Marcy asked.
About dying on the train tracks,
she said, almost shamefully. When was this? Aaron shrugged.
I dream it all the time.
Marcy wasn't sure what to say. Luckily, Barb always had words to spare.
You know, Aaron, when your mom was 5 or 6, she had recurring nightmares. She'd wake up screaming in the middle of the night and then insist on sleeping in my bed, between me and your granddad.
She turned to Marcy. Do you remember that?
Marcy shook her head.
What were they about?
Aaron asked.
Big Bird,
Barb said.
Big Bird? Like from Sesame Street?
The one and only, Barb smirked. Your mom was terrified of Big Bird. She dreamed his nest was inside her closet, and at night, he'd sneak out and try to peck her to death.
Aaron cracked a smile.
That's stupid.
You're making this up, Marcy said. I was never scared of Big Bird.
Hand on heart, you hated that fluffy yellow son of a bitch, Barb said. We can laugh about it now, but at the time, you were genuinely scared. The fear was real because the dream felt real.
Dreams are like that sometimes. But if you're run down by a train in your dream, that don't mean it's going to happen.
Aaron looked at them bleakly.
It didn't happen that way. I didn't get run over by a train.
Your mother said the little dead girl in your drawing was splayed out on a train track, all crooked and gruesome,
Barb said with a hint of relish.
I just assumed she got mowed over by a locomotive.
Mom, Marcy said.
What?
Can I be excused?
Aaron asked. Without waiting for an answer, she padded down the hall, disappeared into her bedroom, and shut the door behind her. It was times like this when Marcy, lying wide awake in the middle of the night in a cramped two-bedroom apartment, wished she had someone to tag into the ring. If motherhood was a battle, being a single parent was like storming the beaches of Normandy without air cover. She thought about Jackson and felt lonely. Marcy's mother was always around when she needed her, but Barb didn't believe in talking about your feelings and addressing emotional problems. She certainly didn't believe in things like mental illness and child psychologists. Barb was of the opinion that when something bad happened, you swept it under the emotional rug and got on with your life. That's how she handled things when Marcy's father passed away. Barb and Tony Keefe were married 26 years before Tony died of lung cancer. In all those years, they only slept apart twice. They lived for each other. Tony was the PB to Barb's J, but when he was gone, she pretended everything was just fine. She must have shed a tear behind closed doors, but never in front of Marcy. Barb was of the suck-it-up generation.
You're on your own, Marce, she told herself. So what else is...
Creak.
The sound of Aaron's door opening. Then, footsteps padding down the hall. Marcy checked the clock radio by the bed. It was after 2 a.m. The apartment was small enough that Marcy knew every creak and crack by heart. She could tell exactly where Aaron was by listening to her footfalls. She listened as her daughter moved past the bathroom and into the kitchen. She might have been getting a late-night juice, Marcy thought, but she didn't hear the fridge door open. For a long moment, she heard nothing, as if Aaron was stood in place. Then came the long, slow shrieking sound of the kitchen sliding window being opened. The wood around the glass had warped, so now every time you opened it, it screamed at you. A series of jarring thoughts snapped into Marcy's mind. Aaron had just opened the kitchen window. Their apartment was on the fifth floor, with a clear drop to a concrete courtyard. Aaron had drawn a dead little girl in her school journal. She swung her feet out of bed and was out in the hallway in seconds. She blazed into the kitchen. The lights were off, but with the window open, she could hear the sounds of the city. Heavy metal music, a crying baby, dogs barking, the whining and moaning of the wind. Marcy hit the lights. Aaron was standing by the open window, her back to Marcy.
Aaron, what are you doing?
Marcy said. Aaron gave no answer. She just kept staring out the window, her back to Marcy. When Marcy moved closer, she caught the sharp smell of urine in the air and saw one leg of Aaron's saggy pajama bottoms was soaked. She hadn't wet herself since she was 3 years old.
Aaron?
Marcy called. She put her hands on Aaron's shoulders. Aaron flinched, as if coming out of some sort of trance. She turned to face Marcy. Her eyes were swollen and red. Fat tears tracked a path down her face.
What is it, honey?
Marcy asked, trying to keep the panic from her voice. Why are you crying? Did something happen?
Erin turned back to the window and pointed.
That's where it happened. That's how I got on the railroad track.
Following her finger, Marcy leaned forward and looked out the window. Between the tall brick apartment buildings of their neighborhood and the sparkling lights of Reston beyond stood Prospect Bridge. A coal train moved slowly beneath it.
I remember falling,
Erin whispered.
You mean you dreamed you fell?
Marcy said.
No,
Erin said.
I didn't dream it, Mom. I remember it.
Dr. Ted Ludlow was a bear of a man, perpetually unshaven and untucked, but there was always a calm smile on his face, which Marcy found reassuring. He'd been their pediatrician since Erin was in preschool. His office was painted a soft, powdery blue with cartoon animals dancing around the walls.
What flavor today?
Ludlow asked Erin, presenting her with an enormous jar of lollipops. The jar was so big he had to hold it with both hands. Erin leaned over them, chewing her lip, a deeply thoughtful look on her face.
Yellow, she said. No, red. No, yellow. Definitely yellow.
Go ahead.
Erin plucked the lollipop from the jar and began to unwrap it.
Now take that out into the play area, he said. Your mom will be out in a second.
Erin stuffed the lollipop into her mouth, handed Marcy the wrapper, and left the office. When they were alone, Marcy asked, So what do you think?
I think your daughter is a happy, healthy little girl,
Ludlow said.
Bad dreams are common for kids. Recurring nightmares are less common, but nothing to be overly concerned with.
But she wet herself, Marcy said. She hasn't done that since she was three. And all this business about falling off the bridge?
When kids get scared, they regress. I'm sure it's a one-off occurrence. Erin has a big imagination, Marcy, and a dark one by the sound of it. But this is a phase. It'll pass. In the meantime, there are some things you can do to help.
She scrambled for the small notepad she'd brought along with her. With a blue Bic, she took down everything Ludlow said.
Make sure you have a regular bedtime and wake-up time, and no screens an hour before she goes to sleep. You might try getting a nightlight if you don't already have one, and encourage her to take a comfort toy to bed, like a stuffed animal or doll. If the nightmares continue, ask her about them. Listen, but don't indulge. Comfort, but don't coddle. Try to normalize them. But most of all, use your mommy magic.
Marcy stopped writing and looked up. Mommy magic?
When my kids were Erin's age, I told them I had magical protection powers.
He laughed.
My wife even bought a spray bottle and labeled it monster repellent. If the kids ever thought the boogeyman was under their bed or gremlins hiding in their closet, all it would take is a couple of squirts and they'd quiet right down.
You want me to lie to her?
That's what most of parenting is, Marcy,
Ludlow said with his trademark grin.
We teach our kids not to lie with one breath and tell them a fat man in a red suit brings their Christmas presents with another.
She forced a smile. You really think the bad dreams will just go away?
Trust me,
he said. But they didn't. Marcy did all the things Ludlow had suggested, but nothing helped. She imposed a strict bedtime and took away Erin's tablet an hour before she climbed under the covers. She dug out the old Harry Potter nightlight Erin had grown out of at 4 years old, and even tried a little mommy magic. This juice has special powers, Marcy said one night over dinner. It's made from Tibetan cranberries grown by monks, designed to stop little kids from having nightmares. Eyeing the glass with suspicion, Erin said, Mom, that's stupid. So much for monster repellent, Marcy thought. 2 weeks passed without change, and Marcy found herself sitting up most nights, feeling useless, like a bad mother. On one of those late nights, when sleep seemed impossible, she got out of bed and went into the kitchen. She cracked one of the beers she kept in the fridge for Barb and sat down at the kitchen table with her laptop.
She took a big breath and a bigger sip, then typed Prospect Bridge plus suicide into the search engine. Before hitting the return button, she hesitated. She had avoided Googling the bridge because she hadn't wanted to indulge a fantasy. But she had also lived near the bridge long enough to know its reputation, so she hit the search button and wasn't surprised at all when an overwhelming number of links appeared. She clicked on the first one. It took her to an archived newspaper article from the Seattle Thinker, which read, Suicide Bridge. Prospect Bridge is an iron truss suspended 200 feet above the icy waters of the River Chancy and the Milden Train Yard. It boasts stunning views of the city, especially at sunset, but as its macabre and heartbreaking history attests, it's far more famous for darker reasons. Prospect is known as a popular suicide hotspot because more than 260 people have jumped to their death since the bridge was opened in 1932. The only other bridge in the country with more suicides is the Golden Gate. Within weeks of its opening, a man named Frederick H. Burrow was the first to leap from the bridge. The city had seen a particularly healthy rainfall that year, so when Burrow's body landed in the shipping channel, his body floated 5 miles in strong currents before it washed ashore at a gristmill in Robbinsville. Barely a month after Burrow met his end, two more men committed suicide within a span of 3 days. The second man missed the water and instead landed on a railroad car that was parked in the train yard for loading. By the end of 1934, the death toll had reached 11. The bridge soon earned a reputation for being haunted. It's as if the bridge is calling to these people, wrote an anonymous contributor to the editorial section of the Seattle Times in September of 34. It's tuned to a frequency that every troubled and demented soul in the city can hear. As early as February 1935, plans for an anti-suicide fence were put forward by the State Department of Transportation, but the project was stalled by engineering setbacks and good old-fashioned American red tape. In the meantime, the death toll continued to climb. By the late 70s, the bridge had already claimed over 108 victims. It became known locally as the Easy Way. In the early 2000s, the Department of Transportation installed a dozen emergency phones and placards with the Suicide Prevention Helpline printed in red. Plans for an anti-suicide barrier were once again put forward and once again stalled. The latest hurdle, historic preservationists who didn't want the facade of the bridge to change. Construction on the fence finally began in 2011, but just 3 months before its completion, the bridge saw another tragedy. On April 4, 2012, Joanne Weir, a prominent Seattle litigation's attorney, became Prospect's latest, and God willing, last victim. It's unclear if the barricade would have stopped Ms. Weir from ending her own life, but it certainly would have stopped her doing it on Prospect Bridge. Marcy stared at the screen, zeroing in on one detail in particular. The last person to die on the bridge jumped on April 4th, 2012, the same day Aaron was born. Marcy didn't know what that meant, or if it meant anything at all, but it spooked her. If she had stumbled across this information during the day, she might have called it a coincidence, but there's something about nighttime that lends itself to wild, irrational thoughts. That's why every problem seems worse at 3 a.m., and why Marcy spent the rest of the night down an internet rabbit hole. A Kids Say the Darndest Things listicle led her to a mommy blog, which led her to a child psychology journal, which took her to a religious forum, to a New Age website, to a paranormal magazine, and finally to the deepest, darkest corners of Reddit, where commenters discussed past life memories and reincarnation. When the first beams of daylight slunk into the kitchen, Marcy got up to make coffee. While she waited for it to percolate, she went to the window and looked out. The dawn sun was rising over Prospect Bridge. Morning came, and Marcy found herself staring at the toaster, willing the bread inside to cook faster. She was running late, as she had for the past week, ever since Aaron's incident at the kitchen window. Aaron, 5 minutes or you're going to be late, Marcy called down the hallway. The toaster popped.
She whipped the toast out and smeared it roughly with peanut butter.
What's with you two lately? Barb asked.
She was standing at the kitchen counter, twirling her car keys around her index finger. She drove Aaron to school whenever Marcy worked the morning shift at Happy Home.
You're like a couple of zombies.
Marcy handed her mother the peanut butter toast. Aaron will have to eat her breakfast in the car.
Not in mine, she won't, Barb said.
Mom.
Fine.
Barb took a bite of Aaron's toast and with a full mouthful asked,
Is everything okay, hon?
Everything's fine. We just had a few late nights. Marcy checked her watch and called out, Aaron, 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Aaron called sleepily from the bathroom. Barb cleared her throat and pointed to a gravy stain on Marcy's shirt. Last night, Happy Home resident Randy McDougal, who suffered from dementia, decided to use his dinner plate as a frisbee, and Marcy got caught in the firing line. She'd been so exhausted when she got home that she forgot to soak it.
Damn it, she muttered.
She stripped to her bra and fetched another shirt from the dirty laundry basket. She sniffed it, winced, but pulled it on anyway. When she returned to the kitchen, Barb was waiting for her.
Marcy, she said, you're what the kids today call a hot mess.
With a sigh that held a note of desperation, Marcy said, She's been having those nightmares every night. She wakes up inconsolable and it takes hours for her to get back to sleep and... She lowered her voice. It's getting weirder, Mom.
Weirder how?
Since that incident by the kitchen window, she's developed a fear of heights. She insisted we move her bed away from the window, and every time we ride the elevator, she squeezes my hand and trembles. She considered telling Barb about her late-night research, but it seemed foolish in the cold light of day.
Honey, you got to get on top of this thing.
That's easier said than done, Mom, she said. Barb gave her a look that Marcy knew well, a subtle rise of the eyebrows, a slight tilt of the head, an almost smile. It was her, I know better than you look. She gave her the same look when Marcy switched to reusable diapers to help combat climate change, and when she insisted on gender-neutral colors for the nursery.
What?
Marcy said.
I didn't say anything.
But you're dying to.
Well, have you noticed Aaron's nightmares seem to get worse the more you indulge them?
She asked.
That creepy drawing, the death dreams, they got a reaction out of you. She's doing it for the attention. This is why I warned you about having an only child. They get bored and weird.
I'm an only child. Case in point. Marcy chuckled, despite herself. She checked her watch and called out to Aaron again.
Okay, kid, you're officially late.
30 seconds,
Aaron shouted back. Barb called,
Girl, if you don't get your butt out here soon, I'm gonna eat all your breakfast.
Aaron emerged seconds later. Her eyes were sunken and dark, her skin white.
Good Lord, Barb said. You look like a meth addict.
Aaron yawned and shoved what was left of her peanut butter toast into her mouth. Marcy lifted Aaron's school bag to hand it to her. Aaron snatched it and snapped,
Don't touch my stuff.
Geez, calm down, Marcy said. I was trying to help. But Aaron just huffed along on her way. Barb took a few steps after her, then turned back to Marcy.
Think about what I said, Barb told her.
Marcy did think about it. She spent the first half of her shift at the Happy Home on autopilot. While her body ladled out raisin oatmeal to the residents, administered John Kirshner's meds, and helped Anna Sobelston on and off the toilet, her mind was somewhere else. If her mother was right and Aaron was doing all this for attention, surely the solution wasn't to ignore the whole thing. Problems didn't stop being problems just because you didn't talk about them. They festered and grew. That's how it had been with her and Jackson. She thought about all the things she didn't tell her mother growing up, out of fear Barb would bite her head off or worse, pretend it didn't happen. Her first period, the night she lost her virginity, that time she blacked out at a party and had vague memories of fucking someone. Marcy didn't want that for Aaron. She decided, and not for the first time, that Barb was wrong.
Earth to Marcy, Patty Windler said. Happy Home's resident ballbreaker was kicked back in a dusty blue recliner in the rec room, waving the TV remote in Marcy's direction. Huh? Marcy asked. Patty had asked her something, and Marcy had been so deep in thought she hadn't heard. But to be fair, even when Marcy's head was in the game, she had a habit of zoning Patty out.
I asked you to change the damn channel on this damn thing, Patty said. My hands ain't worth shit no more, and this remote ain't much better.
What do you want to watch?
The Netflix one with all them gays.
Queer Eye? She nodded. Marcy tried to switch the TV from free to air to Netflix, but Patty was right about the remote. Hold on, I think it needs new batteries. Allie Trimble came toward them. Her polo was unbuttoned, revealing the tip of her cleavage. Marcy could just make out the tail of her dolphin tattoo. I just replaced the batteries, she said. It's the buttons. You've got to press them down hard. She took the remote from Marcy's hand and squeezed. The Netflix banner appeared and Patty said,
Finally.
While they waited for the show to load, Happy Home had notoriously sketchy Wi-Fi. Marcy asked, Hey, do either of you remember hearing about a woman who jumped off Prospect Bridge?
I've heard about a lot of people jumping off that old thing, Patty said. When I was growing up, we'd call it eating the train tracks.
This would have been 9 years ago, Marcy said. She was the last jumper before they put up the barricades. She was an attorney, I think. Allie's face grew sullen.
Oh,
that was a real sad story. You remember when it happened? A few months before that poor woman committed suicide, her daughter died in a car accident. It was on the news. The kid's dad was driving, had some sort of an epileptic fit, and drove right off the road. He walked away with a few cuts and scratches, but the kid didn't walk away at all. There was talk at the time, but it never came to anything. What sort of talk?
Like maybe the guy did it on purpose? I mean, if you know you're epileptic, you probably shouldn't be driving a car, right?
And that's why his wife killed herself?
Taking the easy way out is the coward's way, Patty interjected. I've always said that and always will. But as far as reasons go, that woman had a pretty darn good one by the sound of it.
Patty turned to face the TV. It was a clear sign she was done talking. If you're looking for something to do, I need help lifting Herm into the tub, Allie said. How could I resist? On their way to East Ward, where Herm Clarence Furlong was waiting for his bath, Marcy asked,
Do you believe in an afterlife, Allie?
Allie turned to her slowly with wide eyes.
Jeez Louise, Marcy, don't you know it's polite to warn a lady before you throw something like that her way? Have you been into Ruby's anticholinergics?
Marcy faked a laugh. Sorry, that was a left fielder. I just know you spend a lot of time in palliative, and I don't know, it's just been on my mind a lot lately. It's not something I've ever really thought about. Even when I lost my dad, I mean, I said all the prayers and sung all the hymns, but I never really thought about it.
I think about it all the time, Allie admitted. It's hard not to, working in a place like this, losing a resident every other month. I don't believe in God, but I believe there's something after all this. Otherwise, what would be the point, right?
They reached the stairwell at the end of the corridor and climbed it to the second floor. Sunlight fell in through the windows, illumining hundreds of dust motes. But how can you be so sure? Marcy asked. Don't you need, I don't know, proof?
For me, and if I had to guess, for a lot of the folks in palliative, faith isn't about knowing death is not the end. It's about hoping it isn't.
When they reached the top of the stairs, Allie stood in front of the stairwell door, blocking Marcy's way.
Is everything okay, Marce?
It would have been easy to tell Allie nothing was wrong. Instead, she blurted everything. She told her about Aaron's drawings, her bad dreams, her memories, things she hadn't even told Barb. When she was finished,
she felt emptied out. She took a long, deep breath and braced herself for Allie's response.
That's why you were asking about that woman that killed herself?
Marcy nodded.
I think I know someone who might be able to help you, she said.
Marcy blinked at her, stunned. You mean you don't think I'm crazy?
There's a place I go when I need spiritual counseling.
Spiritual counseling? You mean a therapist?
Not exactly, Allie said.
How much do you know about past life regression? Arndale, the next town over from Milden, was a land of concrete, car yards, and shopping malls. It was another hot day, with sweltering blacktop in both directions. Marcy stood before Soul Potential, a spiritual counseling center sandwiched between Doggy Dug pet groomers and a 7-Eleven. Soul Potential was a converted shopfront. There were a dozen different crystals and trinkets in the front window. Stenciled on the glass beside bullet points was hypnotherapy, emotional freedom technique, soul-based readings, and, bizarrely, womb memories. Wind chimes over the door jingled as she entered. It was a little cooler inside. Soft harp music drifted down from a speaker mounted in the corner of the waiting room. The lighting was so low that it took a few seconds for Marcy's eyes to adjust, until the dark shapes of the room came into focus. The chairs in the waiting room were deep and wide, positioned around a bubbling Japanese-style water feature. Framed spiritual posters lined the wall. One showed the silhouette of a meditating man, his chakras represented as glowing balls of color. The multi-armed, elephant-headed Hindu god Ganesh featured in one, the Buddhist lotus flower in another. There was only one other person in the waiting room, a skinny woman in her 60s, with long gray hair and a striking lime-green pantsuit. She smiled at Marcy and said, "Another hot dog of a day, ain't it?" Feeling nervous, Marcy just nodded. A receptionist appeared through a curtain of beads. She was imposingly tall, with black hair and blacker lipstick.
"Can I help you?"
"I'm not sure," Marcy said. "A friend of mine recommended you. She said you might be able to help me with a problem. Do you mind if I ask you some questions about past life regression?"
"Sure,"
she said.
"What would you like to know?"
"Well, for starters, what is it?" She was shown into one of the offices out back. Compared to the decor in the waiting room, this space was stark and understated. Simple lighting, a modest desk, a well-pruned indoor plant, and two comfortable linen sofas. Marcy sat down on one of the sofas to wait, feeling nervous. She checked her watch. She didn't have all that long left on her lunch break. Besides, what the hell was she doing here? She was seriously considering making a run for it when a short, sturdy Japanese-American man swept quickly into the room on light feet.
"Sorry to keep you waiting," he said. "I'm Takashi Matsui, resident hypnotherapist and fantasy football league expert. It's a pleasure to meet you, Ms. Keefe."
"You can call me Marcy," she said. He sat down across from her and lifted one leg over the other. He had a handsome, angular face and thick eyebrows that seemed to have a mind of their own.
"Our receptionist tells me you're interested in past life regression."
"Yes, well, maybe. I don't know. I'm pretty new to all this stuff."
"We've all lived many lives before this one,"
he began matter-of-factly.
"We tend to pick up emotional baggage along the way and carry it with us from one life to the next. Past life regression is a way to address trauma and resolve problems we experienced in those lives, to help make this one a little easier."
"How does it work?"
"It varies from client to client, but in a nutshell, I use hypnosis to help guide people into their past. They might be depressed or anxious or going through some sort of spiritual crisis, and I help them find the root cause. One of my more interesting clients was a woman who was terrified of loud, sudden noises. If she heard a balloon burst or a car backfire, or even a hefty sneeze, she'd begin to panic. She'd shake and cry. She was displaying symptoms of PTSD, even though she'd lived a relatively safe and sheltered life. Incidentally, she also had a small purple birthmark, right here.
He pointed to his temple.
While under hypnosis, he continued, she remembered being a British soldier, fighting in the Revolutionary War at the Battle of Monmouth. She could describe the battlefield in vivid detail, the sounds, the smells. She then recalled being shot dead, right here.
He made a gun with his hand and pressed it against his head, where the woman's birthmark had been.
It took a few more sessions, but eventually, she got past her fear of loud noises. We can't change the past, but we can learn from it.
Hypnotic regression is a sort of subconscious time travel. Our brains contain a whole load of information that we can't access with our conscious mind. It's like it's all hidden behind a big locked door, and hypnosis gives you the key to open it.
What if that door's already open? Marcy asked.
Matsui leaned forward on the sofa to show Marcy she had his attention.
What do you mean?
Marcy told him about the drawing of the dead girl, about Aaron's dreams and her memories of falling from Prospect Bridge. If Matsui thought she was crazy, he didn't show it. He listened carefully, lips gently parted, eyes fixed on hers. When she was finished, a few beats of uneasy silence fell between them. Marcy couldn't stand the quiet, so she blurted, "Do you think I'm crazy?"
Matsui laughed, a hearty, genuine laugh. "Funny. It's usually me asking that question. And no, you're not crazy. I've actually heard about these kinds of cases before. There was a report about a young boy in Australia who woke up one day claiming he was once a footman of Marie Antoinette's. The kicker? He made this claim in French.
Have you ever treated something like this yourself?"
"No," he said. "And to be honest, I'd be wary of regressing someone as young as your daughter."
"Why? Is it dangerous?"
"It might be,"
Matsui said.
"Children are more susceptible to false memories. That's why parents can condition their children into believing things that didn't happen. A mother might convince her son he had an abusive father to win a custody battle. That sort of thing. If a child is under hypnosis, their suggestibility increases tenfold. They're trained to listen to people in authority, to give us what they think we want."
Matsui must have noticed the blank expression on Marcy's face, because he elaborated.
"You're probably not old enough to remember the Satanic Panic, are you?"
"Satanic Panic?"
"In the 1980s, a moral panic swept through the country," Matsui said. "Everyone was suddenly scared of satanic ritual abuse. Hundreds of patients underwent hypnosis and recovered what they thought were memories of abuse, but when the FBI investigated, they found zero evidence that any abuse actually took place. It was a form of mass hysteria that left a bunch of children with false trauma to work through."
There was a small window in Matsui's office that gave a view of the parking lot. An SUV had just backed in, a stick figure family on the rear windscreen. A flustered mother fished two children out of the back seat and dragged them into the convenience store next door. Slowly, Marcy said, "So, there's nothing you can do to help my daughter?"
"Aaron's past life trauma is manifesting itself as bad dreams and negative energy,"
Matsui said.
"If I agreed to regress her, it wouldn't be about closing the door to her past life. It would be about opening it wider, allowing Aaron greater access, giving her a chance to understand what happened and hopefully process it. That's providing the memories are genuine."
"And if they're not genuine?" His tone grew serious.
"If her memory of the suicide isn't real,"
he warned,
"we could make it real."
At 3:30 that afternoon, Marcy pulled her rattling old Toyota into the parking lot outside Brady Street Elementary, alongside sparkling SUVs and sleek minivans. Brady Street Elementary was a mid-sized school, painted in bright prime colors.
Even the chain-link fence that surrounded the place was a cheery yellow. There was a brick wall near the pickup area where students had been invited to paint a mural. It was a wild mess of flowers, rainbows, scudding clouds, and grinning children. She thought about what Aaron might paint on the wall if given the chance, and pictured the dead little girl on the railroad tracks. The end-of-day bell rang, and children spilled out into the parking lot. Marcy found Aaron's face among them, her mouth slightly open, eyes closed to slits, shuffling like one of the undead. Barb had been right. She was starting to look like a meth addict. Aaron reached the car, tossed her school bag in the back, and lumbered into the passenger seat. "How was school?" Marcy asked.
"Fine,"
Aaron told her. Marcy pulled out of the parking lot and started toward home. "So, I was thinking Giuseppe's pizza for dinner tonight," Marcy said. "What do you think?" Aaron smiled, but it quickly turned into a yawn.
"Can we get a weird one?" she asked. "Kelly says they make something called a pickle pizza."
"What do they put on it?"
"Take a wild guess, Mom,"
Aaron said. Marcy laughed, which got Aaron laughing. It felt good to see her laugh. They pulled onto Littlefield Street, past a cube-shaped office park with reflective windows. She then rolled to a stop behind a red traffic light, signaled to turn left onto War Avenue, and waited for the green. Aaron looked up suddenly. She leaned forward and tilted her head to one side, as if she'd heard a noise.
"You're going the wrong way,"
she whispered.
"What, honey?" "Don't turn here."
She pointed across the intersection to a narrow service road that split from the main road and cut behind a McDonald's.
"Turn left, up there. Horner Street. See it?"
"But War Ave takes us home, sweetie." Slowly, almost trance-like, Aaron said,
"Please, Mom, take Horner Street. Just trust me."
Marcy was a grown woman. Aaron was a little girl. Yet somehow, for reasons that weren't entirely clear to her, Marcy did trust her. When the light turned green, she pulled out of the turning lane, followed Littlefield to Horner, and turned left.
"Where are we going?" Marcy asked.
"Follow this road for a while. I'll tell you when to turn."
Aaron sat up tall like a meerkat, glancing left and right, taking in her surroundings. Horner Street was lined with small wooden houses set back from the street behind chain-link fences and shaggy finger grass.
"There, turn right on Stadelmeyer."
"Have you been here before, Aaron?" She gave a small shrug. Marcy turned right onto Stadelmeyer, then right onto Beetle Street, which took them past West Milden Junior High. Marcy hadn't been to this area of Milden for a long time. In her youth, she'd come here to visit the cool bookstores and to drink with friends in cozy bars. They were all gone now, replaced with spiritless apartment buildings and three-story condo units.
"Turn here," Aaron said. "Finlawn Avenue."
Aaron did as she was told, then said, "Aaron, if you're messing with me, I'll—"
"There,"
she interrupted.
"Pull over."
They had reached the intersection of Tope and Weber Street, bustling at this time of day with school kids and young parents. There was a gas and go on one corner, a bank and row of fast food restaurants opposite. Marcy pulled into a space outside of Wendy's and killed the engine. Aaron unclicked her seatbelt and dashed out of the car. Marcy followed, calling after her, "Slow down and tell me where we're going." Without a word, Aaron crossed to the Weber Street side, to a steel barrier separating the road from a steep embankment. Marcy caught up with her daughter as she arrived at a small roadside memorial just off the sidewalk. Collected at the foot of the barrier was a vase of dead flowers and a stuffed bear, soaked wet and sun-dried. Quietly, Aaron knelt, ran her index finger across the stuffed toy's brown belly. A name was printed there, inside a love heart. Lucy.
"What are we doing here, Aaron?"
Marcy said.
"How do you know about this place?"
Aaron stood and looked down over the railings. The embankment swept down to a concrete channel. Dirty water moved gently down it and would dribble its way all the way to Graybill and beyond.
"I think I had a daughter,
Aaron said, and pointed down at the concrete channel.
And this is where my husband killed her.
Chapter 3. Stan.
Hello, my name is Stan Weir, and I'm a grief survivor.
Around 3 months ago, Stan started going to support groups. Together and Grieving met every Tuesday night at the Rosemead YMCA. Relief from Grief met on Thursdays in Hardin. The Light Beyond was held on Mondays and Fridays in the basement of the Grunley Church. His nights had become a montage of community centers and fold-out chairs, of stale pastries and the smell of cigarettes, of polystyrene cups and long, tight hugs. It sounded depressing, because it was. But sharing helped. That had been a surprise. He'd been put on some kind of grief support mailing list after Joanne and Lucy died. For years, he got leaflets in the mail advertising support groups, and for years, he stuffed them straight in the garbage. He thought he was beyond help, considering himself a lost cause. More importantly, he thought that his pain was worse than anyone else's. How could anyone understand what he had been through? How did losing someone to illness or old age compare to what he'd experienced? So, he spent 9 years bobbing around in the ocean, before finally reaching for a life preserver. Tonight was Life After Death, which gathered every Sunday night at the Milden Community Center. It was a hot and sticky evening. The aircon unit was a dinosaur and did little more than kick warm air around the room. The back doors had been propped open to let the breeze in, but there wasn't much of a breeze to begin with. Despite the heat, it was a good turnout. There were around 12 of them there that night, sitting in a big circle in the middle of the room. There were a few newbies, but most of the attendees were regulars, and most of those were middle-aged to elderly. At 48, Stan was one of the younger ones. "Hi, Stan," the group said in unison.
"I lost my wife 9 years ago," he said, "and I lost my daughter 8 months before that. It should feel like a long time, but it doesn't."
A murmur of sympathy moved through the group. Margaret Bethune, whose husband had died of a rare degenerative brain disorder called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, nodded and dabbed her eyes with a Kleenex. Marge was always crying.
"Do you ever Google grief?" he asked.
There were nods and a few smiles from the group.
"I Googled it the other day and read that the average period of grief is between 6 months and 4 years. 6 months and 4 years. Well, I'm here to tell you, time doesn't necessarily heal all wounds."
One of the newbies, a slim woman in her mid-30s, watched him. She had a pinched, slightly confused expression, as if he were delivering a lecture on thermodynamics. She was wearing denim cutoffs, and as she listened, she picked at a loose thread. Stan wondered who she'd lost to be here.
6 months and 4 years, he repeated. That's all the time you're allowed. Any longer than that, and you become a lost cause. People in your life start to disappear. Has anyone noticed that when something bad happens, you have far fewer friends than you thought?
Agreement from the group. Jim Adkins, a beefy man whose wife was killed by a drunk driver, nodded his head and said,
"Uh-huh."